In the industry, we call them cigarette burns.
That's the cue for a changeover. He flips the projectors, movie keeps right on going, and nobody in the audience has any idea.
Hello and welcome to Adjust Your Tracking. I'm Eric McClanahan.
I'm Joe Von Offen.
That was a good pause there. It was, you know,
it was calculated.
Yeah, I figured.
It was a little contrived.
You know what else is calculated, Joe? The release of this monstrosity known as Batman v Superman: Dawn of Justice. We're not going to devote a whole segment to this movie, but we did see it as a good bridge to the real meat of this podcast, which will be Midnight Special. But I think there's things that, you know, we've got to get out there with Batman v Superman.
Yeah, what do you feel is calculated about it? Like the time that it's coming out?
Get calculated, I guess, in the sense that all these gigantic movies like that by big studios are calculated, and but even more so the way the movie was constructed and put together. Just diving right in, they're literally, the movie stops about 2 hours in to give you a trailer reel for the future Justice League characters. I know, and like, so we've already, you know, talked about this movie on the previous, on the Playlist podcast. I talked with it, with several staff members from the Playlist, but now that you've caught up with it, I mean, I feel like I gotta know, you've endured it. You did not like Man of Steel.
No, I kind of loathe Man of Steel. Just like, it's the way it wears its brooding kind of gloom, like an Instagram filter, as opposed to the sort of existential dread that Christopher Nolan fine tunes in the Dark Knight movies. Mm. It just, after it's something, some style has been established, people just start applying it without any sort of finesse. And like, that's what Man of Steel felt like, is that it was like this brooding, introspective version of the Superman saga. And it was just like, it was so aggressive and bombarding. And I feel like BVS, DOJ, is that the full acronym?
You got it, dude.
BVS DOJ is like, it ups the thundering idiocy of everything. And it's just like, any problem you may have, any sort of like, just qualms with the logic of the movie, they just get screamed over. And even if you find yourself getting bored with the action, which you will, which is like, that's so striking and upsetting to me, that the action is the most, like, one of the most boring parts of these movies. And it's just,
yeah,
like,
it's shocking.
Isn't that why you're going? And so the movie just shrieks over like your growing disinterest, your impatience, your discomfort. And then so people are just like, I think people will mistake being overwhelmed and bombarded with being entertained anymore. Like, there's just, that seems to be the case. And like, BVS DOJ is like, is the worst example of that, or the best of the worst, basically.
Right. And like, well, I'd still put those Transformers movies as a little bit.
100%. Like, right. The Transformers movies are like, I thought of them a lot. And I thought of like the Michael Bay kind of Zack Snyder, Predator high five they would do to each other. Maybe they hate each other, I have no idea, but like, they just seem one in the same, you know?
Yes.
And it was funny, because like, I tried to talk myself out of seeing this movie. I was like, you've already seen it, you know everything that's going to happen in this movie, you know how you're going to feel. I'm just fogging up my mirror, like saying this to myself in the mirror. And and your like message to me, you had seen it and you're like, it's not as bad as people are saying. And I was like, I just wanted to like, transport myself to you, like the Flash does in
in this movie, inexplicably
out of a dream. Yeah. and just be like, that's the worst, to say it's not as bad as everybody's saying. Cause people are just going because it's familiar. It's what they know. It's like this established thing that they feel like they should go to. And it's just like, I see these bickering arguments back and forth, and the best people can say is that it's not as bad as you're making it seem. Like, that's not good. That's not something to fucking aspire to as a filmmaker or as a film goer. Like, you shouldn't just be like, it's not that bad. Like, yeah, it kind of is that bad. It's idiotic. It doesn't make any sense. And I'm sitting there, I was like, I have to make this 2.5 hours not be painful. So I took two Advil ahead of time. Not kidding. And so I was like, so in the opening sequence, when we're introduced to Bruce Wayne again, watching his get killed.
Again.
Like, there's a strange kind of, like, I don't know, like hallucinatory quality to everything. Like you watch his parents get shot close range in slow motion while you're watching the child version of Bruce Wayne plummet also in slow motion down a well. And there's something like kind of borderline hysterical about it. And it's like, there's no logic or coherence to the movie yet. This is the opening credits. And I was like, what if this is just weirdly operatic? And what if it's just this weird, unglued kind of almost giallo type movie that, because I've been told enough ahead of time, the movie makes no sense. Like the giallo movies, the Italian horror movies, never attempted to make sense. They had a dream logic to them that barely held together under scrutiny. So it was just like, it was a weird assembly of images that were kind of hypnotically put up against each other with a thin thread of coherence that would just wash away with a bunch of blood, you know? And so it's like, maybe if this movie is just a fever dream, like I'll be able to enjoy it that way. But soon enough, the plot starts and it becomes like really wooden and kind of, and just stupid and humorless. And it was just like, what is this for? Like if comic book nerds are being like, well, it's not supposed to be high art. I'm like, okay, that's fine. That's fine. But it's not entertaining either. Like it's not entertaining or dramatically involving or, you know, exciting, because the action is fucking numbing and irritating and assaulting eventually. And it's just like, I don't know. Like I was looking for a reason, because like you and I have talked about this before. Like we don't like to hate our experiences. We like to feel like our time is well spent and that we've given ourselves to something dramatically involving, you know? And so I tried. I tried for like entry points, and I was just like, no, that's, well, I mean, Ben Affleck's pretty good. He's kind of puffy. So he just looks like a, you know, kind of water retented Batman. That's different. And Henry Cavill, I'm not really 100% on board with him. And Amy Adams, bless her heart, has like the only, I think, dramatically credible moment in the film. And Jeremy Irons, I think, is a good Alfred.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, now we know why Ben Affleck was so like muscular in Gone Girl. I mean, like he was.
Yeah, totally.
He was doing training montages for this movie.
Don't you feel like it just felt like no one was in the same movie, though? You know what
I mean? Oh, absolutely. Like, I mean, the height of that is Jesse Eisenberg as Lex Luthor, where I almost feel bad for the guy. Because
he was swinging for the fences and like.
And he's having really fun where nobody else is really having fun or not playing to be having fun. They're playing it seriously. And Eisenberg actually tries to inject a level of fun, and it's like the worst case scenario of what you're talking about. He belongs in a completely different movie.
Yeah.
But then again, this is about five movies squished, hammered, jammed, packed together, so much so that they're like, the movie debuts this last weekend, and they're like, don't worry, we've got the half an hour longer R-rated cut coming.
No thanks. I don't care what. And that was the other thing, is that like, it's this, do you remember when there was rumors of Darren Aronofsky doing a Batman movie? Is prior to the Christopher Nolan ones.
Yeah, he was going to do Batman Year One, like his own version of that, yes.
Right, and so he was just primed to make this super gritty, like really fucked up. This is after, I think, Requiem for a Dream.
Yep.
And he was like, you know, kind of, he was gunning for it being an R-rated one. And so it's just like, you see kind of, like, I felt like a lot of this movie, I was watching Zack Snyder drunk in a sports bar yelling about how he's gonna make that movie, but I was watching the movie, but it just felt like I was watching the conversation of him like, I'm gonna make that fucking movie, man, there's gonna be pedophiles in it, it's gonna be super fucked up, man. And like, that's what it felt like, and none of it landed. Like it was just like, okay, here's all this new superficial grit, and none of it, and it's just depressing. It's not for kids. And I think people, I see grown-up nerds talking about how that's cool, like how, and not that, I don't think everything should be for kids,
right?
Completely. In fact, like, I hate that everything's catered towards a PG-13 friendly audience, but it's like, understand that you're making a superhero movie, like, so you're making it for people like in their from their 30s to 40s to just like pat themselves on the back with, like, why wouldn't you make it like elated and fun in parts, because it's not fun in any way.
Right. And that's the most confounding thing is that that approach that you're talking about is the one you'd think Warner Brothers would be hewing to, would be going for, since this is the thing that creates their next decade slate of big movies, essentially. Right. And yeah, I think the movie's already made a ton of money, as we've talked about on the prior Playlist podcast, and that's basically everybody's talking about it this week. It's made lots of money, but will it really make the money required to make this behemoth,
sure,
overpriced thing, piece of crap movie, basically, like, to make it profitable? It might not, and now it's established as this is the way these movies are now. So, and it's it's troublesome.
It is troublesome, and like your kind of answer, as honest as it was, like it's not that bad, is just like that sort of shrugging resignation that is just like, this is, you know, well, if these are movies are going to come out, you know, we got to see them. And it's just like, I wish this one would burn up in flames. And like, so as much as I think it's hyperbole to say it's the worst, because I think it's also hypocritical, because there's plenty of other like movies just like it that don't get the same ire. So it's like, why arbitrarily scrutinize this one? Like, maybe Zack Snyder's not that likable of an individual. Who knows? I've never really, besides the Dawn of the Dead remake, liked one of his movies. So maybe that's why the people just want to rip, critics at least want to rip it apart.
I think so. I mean, yeah, because critics, for the most part, and definitely audiences, they feel warmer to a Joss Whedon or a Jon Favreau, right, you know, but they've each made, I would say, bad sequels to their Marvel movies.
Sure.
To me, BVS, DOJ, it's amazing how more complicated it is to acronym that. It's on the same level as like an Avengers 2 or Iron Man 2, and it suffers from a lot of the same problems. It's just, one is coming out, is out now and made by this director that I think less critics are a fan of. I think those Marvel movies sort of get more of a pass because they are fun. They're all fun in some way. They're forgettable.
Yeah,
as hell,
exactly.
But,
I mean, even the bad ones, like there's a clip to them. There's at least a likability to, you know, Robert Downey Jr. in Iron Man 2, which was a fucking mess. But like, yeah, I still watched it, and like, I at least wasn't bored, like, because like, I'm aware of the mechanics of why BVS DOJ is not working, like, as I'm watching it, because I'm so disengaged from everything, because from scene to scene it's just not working. Yeah. Like, the logic doesn't make any sense, and just like the characters' motivations are completely senseless. Like, and I think you know maybe somebody would argue like, he's giving the audience the benefit of the doubt that he's not overloading a bunch of backstory onto them. But it's like, well, yeah, but let's assume like nobody knows who Lex Luthor is, because has he been established in any other franchise movie? No. So it's just like, nobody knows who he is. Nobody knows what his motivation is. And so it just comes across as bad writing. You know what I mean? It's just like motiveless people who are just kind of like grinning, and you know, I don't know, like, it's just the whole movie just didn't hold together except for the mechanics of like the score and the action set pieces. Like, they would get to an action set piece and I'm like, well, this is at least competently done, I guess. I don't really understand what's going on inside of it. But how we got here or why we're even here, like, was never spelled out, and I don't feel like it's because I wasn't paying attention.
No, it's because the movie, it is bad writing. You say it feels like bad writing. It is. I mean, and it's really the most deflating, depressing thing as just an avid moviegoer, as a fan of movies, is that so much money spent on something, so much resources,
it's
so
crazy.
many talented
people. Suffer because it makes it back. It has a titanically big opening weekend, and it's just like, all right, so there's no, like, we won't rise to the standards that are like set for us, because we're willfully eating fucking garbage. You know what I mean? Like,
but what if this is the movie that sort of sets the course soon for that big failure that like Spielberg and Lucas were talking about years ago? That like one or two or maybe three of these movies in a year will implode to such a degree. Like, you'll have more than just a Fantastic Four in like last year. You'll have you know, a movie on this scale, like BVS, DOJ, or whatever comes in its wake, they might be the ones that fail hard because though the audience has sort of at best, like you've said, say, oh, this movie's not as bad as everybody's saying. I don't think it seems like most people don't like it all that much. And you will see how people really felt about this movie when it comes time for that next, for that sequel, for that Justice League movie, because that's going to be the response from what people thought about it. Right now, we're seeing the response from all the people that bought into the marketing or that we're going to see right. it opening weekend. So
no matter what. Yeah.
Like, it's
when I saw it yesterday, there was no one in the theater. There was five people in the theater, and it was a gigantic 70 millimeter screening room. And it was just like, maybe this is just, I know we've talked about this before where it's like after opening weekend, like, theaters will be like lonely and desolate during the week, you know, because like nobody's going to like matinees. I went to a 5 o'clock show, so it should have been picking up, but like there was no one there. And I was like, well, this is the number one movie at the box office and no one's here. So it's just like maybe it did have an initial rush and then it's just like petering out basically.
I think it's going to peter out fast too, but we'll see. I mean, you alluded to that it's like made its money back. Not really when you look at it. It has to, apparently the word is that this movie has to make $1 billion with a B dollars.
Oh my God.
To be profitable, dude. Like north of like 800 million is when it will break even, they say.
That's crazy.
It's because of all the money they've spent on the, not just the budget, but like the marketing, which was massive for it. And really, I think that's one of many ways of the things we've already talked about that sort of lead me into a movie that we actually do care about, really here to talk about is, and it's put out by the same studio, Warner Brothers.
Crazy.
I know. It's so crazy. And then within weeks of each other. It is our movie of this episode. It's Jeff Nichols' Midnight Special.
What do you know about Alton Meyer?
He would have fits.
Things would break. Cars would shut down, that kind of thing.
Others have described seeing things. Did he show you things?
Yes.
What kinds of things?
I wouldn't know where to start.
We need to know where he is.
You'll have no clue what you're dealing with, do you?
I mean, just to start, this movie cost $20 million to make, is what Jeff Nichols said in an interview. One place to start. This movie looks bigger, feels bigger, looks better than whatever they spent on Batman versus Superman, which was, you know, 250, 300 million just
to whatever
make.
They spent on the bus ads. Batman versus Superman was what they spent on Midnight Special. And you feel every dollar, like,
God, it's all up there
working. And like, I was thinking about between the two movies, like the physiological response. And like before seeing BVS DOJ, we could retire that in a second. I felt genuine dread. Like, I was just like, I don't want to see this. I don't want to sit through another one of these. I don't want this experience. And like, I feel like the defiance of that experience, because it's becoming monotone, is like necessary in order to just like not have this become all there is. And so when seeing Midnight Special, which I was like, I didn't know much about, you know, honestly, like we love Jeff Nichols' work, obviously, you know, his first film, Shotgun Stories, is like a fantastic little slice of life.
Oh yeah.
And Take Shelter, we both were big proponents for. And then his like detour, like from Take Shelter, because it looked like he was maybe treading in genre territory. He just went to a straight up, very involving and unusual coming of age movie, like with a down south kind of bent. And like, it's incredible. And
for,
so it's
for Mud,
like,
you're talking about.
Yeah, Mud. And so like, he's building this like this pedigree. But I didn't know much about it. And so I kind of went in somewhat uninformed, just knowing that it was like a science fiction movie. And like, if dread was my experience, like leading up to going to see Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice, I'm just going to acronymize it.
Just do it.
You save time. Time is important, especially when you lost 2.5 hours of your life yesterday. So like the feeling I felt as Midnight Special started, and like all the economy with the storytelling. So opening scene inside a motel, and like you're introduced to Michael Shannon's character, Joel Edgerton's character, and what's the name of the actor who plays the young child?
Alton. The actor's name is Jaden Lieber.
Yeah, Jaden Lieber.
Great little actor, man.
Yeah. So you're a near wordless exchange between all three of them as they're sort of gearing up to leave a motel room, and you're given all the information you need. Yeah. Like you're given the sort of how the characters carry themselves, the world they live in, how ultra realistic it is. And this is like just great storytelling and great script writing. And like you feel as they exit that motel room and you have all this information of that, like there's a Amber Alert out for Alton Meyer, which is the character's name of the child. And just everything's given to you. And there's just a sense of like mounting kind of dread and threat. And like, and the movie starts and there's a feeling of genuine atmosphere. We talked about this, I remember, with Cop Car, that as flawed as that movie was, there was a sense of place. Like you felt like you were in an actual environment, like in the sort of Badlands terrain that movie took place in. Mm-hmm. And that became its own character. And I think that was invaluable to the movie, as flawed as it was. And Midnight Special is just like, it's set in the South, and like it's world building and sense of like documentation is like, it's incredible. And like, as it was this physiological response I'm talking about, like I just started to cry. As like hyperbolic as that sounds, like I was just so like, I was like, I'm in with this movie. Cause they like, they realize as they get into the car, and they're like obviously trying to like outrun somebody, and they hear the APB go out that their car has been spotted, and they know that like Alton Meyer, the child who there's an Amber Alert out for, is in the car. Mm-hmm. And so they veer off down a side street, and like as soon as that takes off and like the Midnight Special like title comes up, so it was just good. Like chills. Yeah, and it's like so the movie good. Doesn't stop, the movie never stops. But for that kind of like constant pace, you were still given every bit of room and every bit of nuance and character and like a sense of stake and a sense of involvement and humor and everything that I've been missing from movies nowadays. It just feels squeezed and hyper compressed and suffocating. Like it all was there. Yeah. And so for all of like the times a giant rage monster punches Superman and or Batman through a building and everything in the entire world is exploding, like I would rather watch a simple exchange between two people in this movie over and over again, or watching Joel Edgerton see a family hug and have his entire character's life visible on his face while he's doing next to nothing. Like, yeah. Sorry.
I got chills just like, thinking about that.
Like
I'm
Batmaning over like your exchange. Like I'm just screaming over you right now.
It's okay. I Joe, I love this excitement, and you got me excited when you've had this movie in LA for a couple weeks now because of its initial limited release. So I've just been jealous, you know, and we do this to each other. We sort of tease each other when one of us gets to see a movie we both want to see in advance like this. And it's happened for me with Green Room last year, for instance, and you know we're gonna get to that one in a future soon enough episode. But yeah, I love this excitement because I think we both anticipated this movie to be one that we would really go for. Mm-hmm. But so there's an inherent level of hype that we put into this because we like Jeff Nichols. The movie sounds pretty cool. And a different kind of hype, but no less, you know, the stakes are just as high for us personally, for this movie to live up to that for us. And yet it for me, and it sounds like for you, surpasses that. It reminds you of how good a studio, like this is a genre movie. It's a multiple genre movie, but it's a genre movie. It's a chase movie, sci-fi, fantasy, whatever you want to label it as. It's how good they can still be. And I think the reason we're really quick to want to clutch our arms around it and really just not lose this movie and, you know, like go to bat for it and just praise it to high heaven is because we don't get these movies very often.
No.
I mean, people talk about the like mid-level adult drama going away. Well, what's been gone for basically forever is this kind of movie, a studio low-budget genre movie. Like that's insane. I mean, we get a Looper every now and again. We get a Sicario, something like that. Or, you know, another comparison would be like J.J. Abrams' Super 8, which is sort of an interesting movie to look at when you look at Midnight Special, because both these movies have a reverence for the era of filmmaking and movies that I think you were feeling instantly with this movie that anybody that's on board with Midnight Special should feel, is like, if you grew up in that era, is like a great 70s, but like also into that 80s sort of chase genre movie that still has heart to it. For me, the big difference against something like Super 8, which neither of us really went for, didn't think it was bad at the time when it came out, but
yeah,
you know,
I think our gripe was that it had a reverence for those movies, but what it did was create like a kind of museum perfect diorama version of the world. Whereas like what the Spielberg movies of that era, the like Close Encounters, Poltergeist, even though he didn't direct it, and E.T., like he was documenting the world that was in front of him at the time. Yes. And so like creating the sort of Amblin, you know, quote unquote universe for 2011 when Super 8 came out, it was just like, well, like why are you doing, like it's more important to capture the spirit than it is the like cosmetics of it. And so, I mean, Jeff Nichols grew up in the South, like his life is in the South, and like that's the world he knows. And so he knows how to capture it, and he knows how to like pinpoint. And so the spirit of those movies is intact, whereas like it may look physically different. I mean, it doesn't, to me it doesn't, but he's not trying to like capture a sort of aesthetic of 1982 in, you know, Southern California suburbia. You know what I mean?
Right. It's all just like, it's more organic with this movie. And I think Jeff Nichols has said, and this is his style, is like he kind of thinks of or he's struck by like a really strong metaphor that hits him, and he tries to like design a story around that. And I think that right there is like the biggest special effect that Midnight Special has to play.
His entry point is always like it is something personal. So like when he was developing this story, he wanted to have like a sci-fi chase movie. And like that part was sort of like, that was the through line, but he needed to have something to sort of like to latch on to make it actually come to life. And so like he had a personal sort of incident where his child was born and like something went wrong, and it was like, it was possible that they were going to lose their baby, basically.
Right.
And the thought, like that sense of fragility and that sense that like maybe the baby didn't belong with them on Earth, like that sense of like that impending sort of like dread and danger and stake is just like that's all over this movie, in the sense that like, so Michael Shannon plays Alton Meyer's father, and so he's essentially abducted his own son in the eyes of the law, who are after this child, and you're sort of putting together what, why the FBI is after the child, and why this church group, kind of similar to the Branch Davidians in Waco, like why which is where they escape from, like why they want the child. And so slowly you're putting together like why Alton is special and stuff like that. And so just the sense of like this family keeping it together and that personal investment, and how all of that sense of like stake and like loss, potential loss, is all established like so clearly through like Michael Shannon's face, like, and so clearly through just their interactions with each other. And like, it's so minimal and so economic and so just beautifully done and beautifully performed. And like, just seeing the synergy between performance and technique and filmmaking technique is fucking, it's beautiful and such a heartening reminder of like what we love, you know?
Right.
Just to see Michael Shannon like breathing heavily in a scene that's really intense. And then the scene cuts to an overhead shot of traffic at night. And this is just this beautiful sense of like, oh God, what happened? And like, oh, now we're just like lost in this like beautiful image. And right. So like he's able to ground this like sense of propulsion, this chase movie that he wanted to make in the personal, you know? Yeah. And like that's all been like eradicated, I feel, in like modern movies.
In big movies, it really has.
Yeah, the big movies, for sure.
It's like because he operates from a sense of like metaphor, at least with this movie, and I'd say its closest cousin to him is Take Shelter.
Yeah.
Where the interesting switch here is that the way I read Take Shelter is that it's not really supernatural. The things we're seeing are... the things that the character, Michael Shannon's character in Take Shelter, is seeing are based on his fractured psychosis. Like,
yeah.
The guy's going through it. That's the way I read that movie, and that's what makes it such a strong film to me. But here, we the things are really happening. The supernatural is there, but the metaphor is maybe even stronger in this one, and it allows him to ground the film in a reality, like you said, in a relatable reality, because he gets personal, he gets specific, which in a lot of cases, and I would say with this one, makes it universal. I don't have kids, but I can see and get invested in the emotional stakes between a mom, a dad, and their little boy possibly leaving them forever, or them not knowing what to do, but knowing that they've got to help their boy get to this next stage. That right there is brilliant, but it also allows for these moments. And that's where I feel it's the anti-Super 8, because it's not so slavishly trying to recreate the Spielberg feel. It's just taking the best elements from what Spielberg back then especially was had like a natural gift for. Like, to me, Jaws is my favorite movie of all time for a lot of reasons. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest is the scenes where the little boy is mimicking his dad at the dinner table. And these little moments where you latch on to a real thing, a little brief fleeting moment, and it's gone, but it like... it makes everything so real. So then when a giant shark sinks a boat, you kind of can go with it. Not only because you're invested in that story, but you're invested in those characters because you've mm-hmm. lived with them a little bit. And man, all of Jeff Nichols' movies have that. But in Midnight Special, it's like not just the glue for all the scenes. It's just like it adds so much more to it. So when we see the scene you reference where Joel Edgerton looks at this family as they kind of have this moment where they hug it out together is so touching. But I even think of a little moment that really struck me in Midnight Special was Kirsten Dunst, who's the mother of this boy, and she kind of gets picked up about halfway through into this movie and becomes involved in the chase and with them, is Alton, the little boy, is taking a shower in a hotel bathroom, mm-hmm. and she just does what any good mom would do, right? She knocks on the door and says, "Are you okay in there?" And you just hear the boy just say, "Yeah, yeah, yeah, I'm good." You know, like mm-hmm. it's such a essentially a nothing moment when we think of movies. Like, everything sometimes feels like it has to be something big, but it's not. It is the important stuff in a Jeff Nichols movie. And it's like moments like that. Kirsten Dunst just being a mom, you know, and the movie giving that breathing for longer than even that moment, but allowing that moment some room to breathe is just like part of what Jeff Nichols' inherent gift is as a filmmaker.
You don't have to worry about me.
I like worrying about you.
You don't have to anymore.
I'll always worry about you, Alan. That's the deal.
Yeah, it's hard not to gush about a movie like this. Like, I can't wait to see this movie again because I feel like there's so much to offer. And I hope the same effect happens for people that go to see it, because it's going wider this weekend. And they're doing this sort of slower rollout, which I think is smart for Warner Brothers to do this. Yeah. But I've also heard in some circles that they don't really know what to do with this movie.
Because yeah, and like, to me, that's really depressing. That like
so depressing. It's more depressing than BVS DOJ.
I think if you put good job. I think if you put like anyone in this movie, because listening to like the audience, especially the second time I saw it,
yeah,
just listening to them like react, like people scattered throughout the audience were just like, oh no, like just this the genuine sense of involvement in the drama, and so because you're given all of the room and nuance in the movie. The sense of like the actual action of the film like has the sort of like has the payoff, has the thrill that's kind of been missing in the sort of screaming overloaded movies lately. And it'll be like really economic. It'll be a quick action sequence, like, you know, an exchange of gunfire, or just like, you know, just them losing Alton for a second and then something like being revealed. Like, it's just like these moments that are genuinely thrilling, and to remember that's possible, you know, as opposed to just being like overwhelmed, you know, and sort of like, and exhausted and battered basically by something that's just like thundering at you for 20 to 25 minutes, and like allowing that to be like, yeah, that's what I paid for. Like those explosions, you know.
Or,
and so, like,
or even further, like it might even what you're saying might get into why Warner's it shows the like a problem with the way the big studios work now is they don't know what to do with this movie because they can't hang it off, they can't latch it on to something familiar. And Jeff Nichols, unfortunately, not yet, but I think will be someday, is not like a Quentin Tarantino style name that you can.
Right.
Hang the movie on to market that. So they don't know what to do, but they know they can market the hell and spit out of Batman versus Superman because everybody's familiar with that. And I think that leads into this weird cyclical thing where the directors of a lot of those movies, the big movies, don't really seem to care because you're already familiar. What do you care what Lex Luthor's motivation is, right? Like, you know him, you know Batman, who cares? So then the audience doesn't care.
Yeah.
And that's
so what
danger.
Do you care about, basically?
Yeah.
You know, like, what if you're not there for art, fine. If you're not there, you if it's not really fundamentally thrilling in the sense of entertainment, okay. But what are you then there for? You're not there for the characters because you're just kind of like, you get it, you get it, you get it. No, now here's The Flash. Now here's Wonder Woman. You get it, you get it. And it's just like, huh? What are we here? What is this for? Is this? Are we just collecting action figures and there's no...
Yes.
Like actual investment in what's going on or the world that's being built or destroyed, you know, like I don't.
Yeah.
And so just having all of that, all of the opposite basically on display in a Midnight Special is just like just having people you care about like almost immediately and having them surprise you and having their like the performances really sing and having the technique not ever overshadow or be showy in the movie, but to really just like. Be a beautiful piece of work, and like the music working so
oh my
like
gosh.
Richly.
I mean, David Wingo, who did the score, is like, I thought of it throughout the movie. Even though I will say, next to The Witch, this is definitely one of my favorite scores of this year, like easily. Like, love the throbbing synth, right? And really, what it almost made me chuckle is like, here we go. It's another Carpenter influenced sort of synthy score, but. The fact that, you know, we've talked about this, that Carpenter might be the most influential director on, like, young filmmakers, at least in America, making small genre movies right now.
Yeah.
And in a way, it's, like, familiar, but I'm really still loving seeing the new angles, the new modern approaches to a Carpenter-influenced score like this. And I'm not saying David Wingo just went, I need to make a Carpenter score, or that
no,
Jeff Nichols demanded
it's different
it.
Enough. Like,
exactly.
Especially in the big finale, which genuinely feels like a finale and is like is really emotionally just like raw and involving. Like in that finale, like the music builds and crescendos in this way that's like doesn't sound like John Carpenter. It sounds like something kind of like other. You know, it's got like some Vangelis kind of elements to it, but it's just it's got this like build and this crescendo that's pretty incredible.
Oh god, it's yeah, I mean, and I'm only coming off of seeing this movie about 3 hours ago, really, or 3-4 hours ago, and usually I would like a little more separation from a movie before I'm gonna gush about it, but this is one of those, well, it's like a sure bet. Like I came coming out of it, I'm like, well, I know how I feel about this movie very strongly already, yet cannot wait to see it again.
Yeah.
And it really is a big screen movie. I can't underline it enough. I'll just basically repeat what I said earlier is like, this movie is so much bigger than BVS DOJ. It's so there's so much more at stake. There's just everything that's deficient in that big behemoth monstrosity is what this movie excels in.
Yeah.
And yet I do think because of the way a lot of these studio movies are, the sort of things they're teaching a modern audience are things we've complained about before as well, like infantilizing an audience.
Yeah.
And giving them the type of expectations for a movie that I actually don't think warrant, that doesn't make the best movie. And I find that there will be some people, the wider this movie goes, I'm excited to see how it does, but I think there's going to be some people that want that exposition that they don't get in dialogue in this movie. Mm-hmm. They want the pieces all connected that this movie doesn't want to necessarily lay out for you, but that there might be complaints there. I've talked to a few people who saw it earlier than me that didn't like the ending of this movie, of Midnight Special. And while I am a little perplexed by that because it worked so strongly for me.
Yeah.
I can also understand it, but only in so much as like I see the way the audience is being like sort of trained to watch big movies now, and it can affect a really good little genre movie like this. It might be a divisive movie, but I'm really heartened to hear that your audience, you said, seemed to be quite taken with it and kind of, you know, clutching their you know, their armchairs maybe at the right moments and all that. That's good to hear, because I need to see this now with a big audience. I want to, because I want people to go for it like we are, and I think they can.
Yeah, I hope so. I just, the fact that like I can understand a giant studio's concern, because they gave him basically, he was saying at the Q&A that they let him do what he wanted. You know, and like they,
because he kept the budget so low, essentially.
Yeah. And I think that they liked his track record so far. And so they're like, yeah. And I think with 20 million, there's like a very low risk for a studio. It sounds psychotic that 20 million is a low risk, but
yeah,
like,
think what you could do with 20 million, dude.
Jesus. Yeah. And just like thinking, thank you. Thinking about like BVS, DOJ, like the fact that it has to make $1 billion back, like that's psychotic, but it's just like they gave him, you know, carte blanche to do whatever he wanted, and he delivered. But it's also like, because, you know, like what you were saying with the audience is being conditioned to expect a certain type of experience now, it's so disheartening that like this is a tough sell. You know, it's just like,
right,
you know, like you have great actors, and by the way, you mentioned Kirsten Dunst and like that simple exchange in the motel room. She's so good in this movie.
She's like, so good.
She's amazing in this movie. Like, the entire cast is great. Like, Adam Driver is outstanding in it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And just to see these people who are now, like, rightfully plugged into these big movies. Like, Adam Driver is now in the Star Wars world.
Yep.
And Michael Shannon was in Man of Steel.
Kirsten Dunst was in the old Spider-Man movies.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Joel Edgerton? Like,
Gods of Egypt?
Sure.
Yeah. Not so good.
He's in tons of stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, I love him.
I do too.
But like, and so they've all been, but like seeing them actually work, because it broke my heart to see Michael Shannon in Man of Steel and look like he didn't know what he was doing there. Because he's like, he's used to engaging in like with other actors in a real world, in a real like setting, you know, like I don't necessarily know his entire background, but I know that he's a true like fucking Steppenwolf type actor who has done a lot of stage work and is just used to like getting into the grit of performance, and being in a movie that big and sort of that checked out in terms of like having to just get all this like technical shit fine-tuned, he probably was a little lost, like the way Tom Hardy talks about being lost in Fury Road. But then he was like, you know, he signed off after seeing the movie, Tom Hardy did, and he was just like, I understand why George Miller was distracted, and so it's fine. Like, yeah, okay, good for you.
Okay.
But like other people, you know, if they need a little bit of direction, like I think Jeff Nichols works incredibly well with actors. I mean, just from the performances in his films, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
by the way, I made a mistake. Joel Edgerton was in Exodus, Gods and Kings, the very bad Ridley Scott movie from a couple years ago.
That's right.
Yeah. So I got my whitewashed.
So depressing.
Egyptian
blurring together now, like all of them. Like you could blur that together with Ben Hur now, which is coming out.
Right. And honestly, that's almost in the interest with the way the system is built for these giant movies for the studios.
That's what
it's
I
like,
mean. Like, there's just
forget.
A sense of like, have I seen that? Did I want to see that originally when it came out first? I'll see it again. I don't know. And so there's just like this sense of like familiarity and routine that has nothing to do with like enjoying something necessarily. I mean, these are huge generalizations. So like my apologies if anybody genuinely loves a Batman versus Superman. But
if you do, I'd love to know.
Yeah. Can I ask you some questions?
Yeah, we have so many questions.
Were you awake? I mean, how could you be asleep during that just shriek fest at the end? And then not to mention the bagpipes for the... No spoilers, but there's a lot of bagpipes.
Especially right at the end.
My headache was kicking in.
Yeah. You know, another big movie that I really couldn't help, especially by the end of Midnight Special, that I couldn't help thinking of, that was not only a financial kind of a bomb, but really, I couldn't even... come to its defense as a movie. In fact, one of my least favorite movies from last year was Brad Bird's Tomorrowland. I don't think you ever saw it.
I didn't know.
Yeah. Well, this movie has a lot similar to that movie, actually. And I'm trying to be vague because I don't want to ruin Midnight Special for people. Although this to me is how you do Tomorrowland, and I wanted to defend Tomorrowland when it came out, especially when it did so poorly at the box office, mostly because I'm a big fan of Brad Bird, but also because, like, if you know, if a movie's good and does poorly, you want to defend it and get people to see it. But like, I couldn't even do that because that movie fell to the trap of like needing this big cacophonous, loud, world-threatening ending to it, and all the CG just gets pumped into it, and what do you know, robots start fighting each other for no reason in that movie. It just didn't need it. And what I like is Jeff Nichols takes a similar idea, but one that's an original concept for him, and he sort of strips away all that external stuff. And his exposition is mostly visual, or in these very terse, short dialogue exchanges that don't give you a lot on the surface, but when you dig and pay attention, it tells you everything you need to know, and maybe even more. But we're in a world now where, like, shit, like 2009, when Avatar came out, a lot of people reviewed that movie positively. And I remember some people complimenting, like, Cameron, how he, like, lays out the world so quickly, you know, like, there's this whole beginning, and they tell you what Pandora is, but that's all done by a character literally giving a speech to a bunch of actors in a scene, right, and giving you the laziest amount of, dialogue exposition. What does Midnight Special do? As you already said, it's like, it's doing it visually with camera movements and, you know, bits of dialogue here and there. It's letting you put the pieces together because it trusts you as an audience member.
Yeah.
And I love that because we are smart moviegoers. If you let us, you know, if you let us do that, Hollywood, and Jeff Nichols is a guy that believes in that. And he's doing that with these films, which is just yet, you know, one more reason we have to, like, you know, we're not worthy, Jeff Nichols. Like, we're so, I just think we're lucky. People like you and me, people that genuinely just want good movies. Like you said, you don't have to, if you just want to be entertained, this is still the movie for you. There's no doubt this Midnight Special is the movie for you because it is a genre movie, but it has weight to it. I cared about this movie. I cared about the people in it. And it's harder these days to say.
Because it reminds us of like an era where there was sort of strong storytelling or stronger storytelling and room and nuance. Like, it doesn't feel... In that way, it still doesn't feel derivative in any way. Mm-hmm. Like, it feels urgent and contemporary. And so I feel like it doesn't take much. Like, if you dropped an average audience member who was just, like, you know, used to being like, I like the Superman. And, like, if you just drop them into Midnight Special, it wouldn't take long to acclimate and be like, oh, this is actually a very exciting movie. You know, like...
I mean, that actually technically has a Superman at its heart.
Yeah.
I mean...
there are a lot of like weird overlaps. There's pulling eyeballs. There's Michael Shannon. There's all kinds of just otherworldliness. There's the potential that, you know, Altmaier, this child that everybody's pursuing, like, might not be of this world, and we don't know where he's from. And there's just like, there's just so much, but it's all rooted in, you know, like, in something real, it feels like, in something that has stake, and something that, like, it just makes like the smallest thing seem like huge, you know, and these, the smallest moments that would just like, that get screamed over in every other like film experience, big movies nowadays, is just like, it, like, everything is told in silence. Everything is exchanged in a look, and it's just like, it's all there. And everything that we've been like missing is like completely present and alive in this film.
And what do you know? It comes out in our golden time of year, in the spring.
It's and, true. Yeah.
It's always there to comfort us. And it looks like this month of April and May are going to continue that with the other stuff that's coming out that some of which we've seen and we can't wait to talk about, but you know, a lot of which we're just anticipating because we genuinely love movies and we want them to be on this level.
Yeah.
And they can't always be, but you know, you gotta embrace it when you get it.
One of my, a friend of the podcast, Jay Weinbrenner, who you've seen some of his short work. He did the How Are You Doing short film. He was like, after he and I talked about The Witch, he was like, Joe's dead inside. He doesn't like anything anymore. He's broken. His spirit's broken. And then like I told him that I basically cried out of relief that I liked something when I watched Midnight Special. Because there was just points, there's plenty of points to just to be lost in the story and start to tear up in Midnight Special. But there was just like moments of just grace and like beauty that I was just like, oh god, thank god I like something. I'm so relieved.
I was thankful too. And you know, there's also a sense of awe in this movie that is absolutely missing from the much more expensive movies, because the awe comes from the way the sequences build up to an effect or to a reveal or an action sequence. Because there's a sequence with these satellites that you will remember, and it's just like, it demands you see it on a big screen, but it's also like, wow, an effect, special effects can look fresh these days.
Well, it can genuinely shock you.
Yes.
Just be like, and give you a like the sense of the importance that like in every other huge movie, when they cut to the reaction shot and someone going, oh my God, like you don't feel it. You're just sort of like, here's where this happens. Here's where the Statue of Liberty gets punched out, you know, like, whatever it is. Like, we've just gotten so numb and accustomed to, like, the entire world being blown up over and over again that, like, you do have to make it intimate. You do have to, like, and that's what this movie does, but it also gives you a bigness. It returns to, like, when the big moments happen, they are big and they are, like, genuinely thrilling in a way that they, like, I feel like they just haven't been anymore.
Agreed. Well, I think we could go on for another hour, but I feel like this movie might come up in future coming up episodes.
For sure.
Just because, I'm undoubtedly going to see it again. You just might. You already said you want to see it again. So I think we've got it at a good place here, and we should leave it at that. But I mean, suffice to say, we love this movie. This is the kind of movie that like this podcast was built for. It's what we yearn for when we go to the theater, and it feels so good to have one of those. So yeah, love this Midnight Special. Before we sign out, before we end this episode, we wanted to do to introduce a segment that we should maybe explain a little more thoroughly than we have of recent, because we've been doing it on this podcast for a while. But now that we're on the playlist as one of their podcasts, let's explain what this episode, what this segment Hold Up is, Joe.
Well, Hold Up started as a way for us to take movies that we sort of are beloved to us personally, but may have like a sort of troubled, you know, may have a critical backlash, it's misunderstood in some way. So like there's something kind of embarrassing about our adoration for these movies. This is how it initially was sort of started.
Right.
And so we would bring these movies up and each of us would watch that movie and the other person would act as a critical counterpoint to sort of pick apart why one of us is as attached to the movie as like we are, and maybe see if it is like a hidden gem or it does just sort of like fall apart under scrutiny. So now I think it's become something a little different, where it's just something that we're re-examining movies that may not even be conflicting for us. Like, we just love them. Like, we watched and dissected Slapshot, which I don't think you would even argue as, like, you know, like a questionable movie. You know, right, that it's like it's part of a canon of like sort of established great beloved sports movies. And so we were just taking a look at it to see if like how it holds up over time. And so my pick, and like here I'll give you the angle for it, is Matthew Kasavitz's La Haine.
Oh, beautiful. I forgot. You're right. Yes.
And so to me, it's interesting, especially now, because this movie came out now 21 years ago, or I think it came out in France in 1995, may have made it to the States after Jodie Foster helped usher it into theaters 1986. So it's about 20 years old. And to me, it was a hugely impactful movie. Loved it. But he has yet to make another movie as good. In fact, he's made movies that were kind of wincingly not good. Maybe bad. Gothica, I think it's a terrible movie.
He made one with Vin Diesel, Babylon AD, which I heard was bad too. Yeah.
Crimson Rivers, also with our boy, you know, Vincent Cassell. So, so now it just seems like if you make a sort of bad first feature, especially like if you're given enough means to make a bigger movie, you're kind of you're in director jail. And so it just seems like it's harder for people to make a first impression and then make a follow-up movie that's like that's questionable and then just keep going. So there's like filmmakers like Richard Kelly, director of Donnie Darko, who, you know, made a lot of weird wobbly follow-up movies. And so I'd like to take this time to one, take a look at a movie that is so prescient, that is so like urgent and is so like the film itself just has this like pulse to it. And has this like sense of immediacy about the following these teenagers through Paris as the city's been torn apart by protests against police. And so it's just like, what could be more prescient than like what's going on now with people just reacting to how murderous and corrupt cops have always been. And now it's just undeniable because the proof is constantly being put in front of our faces. So here's this movie, has this urgency, has this relevance today, and also has a filmmaker who we just want to make a movie as good as this one. So
I love it. I love
Lain, coming up next episode.
Yeah, we'll talk about it in more in depth next episode. But if you listen to this and you wanna, if you haven't seen it, I think we can both at this point definitely say you. This is a must watch from like the 90s. This is one of the all time great 90s movies.
It has a Criterion release, which means that it's also streamable on Hulu Plus, so you can watch it there.
There you go. And also, we'll get into this more definitely next episode, but prescient in the way that it, along with the first Pusher movie, I would say, you've heard me drone on about this. They're the easily the most influential crime movies of all the way up until now, until whatever comes in the next 5 or 10 years, or maybe even further. Like you see the ripple effect of these two crime movies, in everything from Gomorrah to A Prophet to all the other great crime movies that have come in their wake. The Pusher sequels even. So there's a lot to chew on with this movie, and I'm excited to just rewatch it, watch it another time. But let's find out if it holds up.
Let's chew in.
All right, so with that, we're going to wrap up episode 126 of Adjust Your Tracking. We are still, you know, you can be found at the newsroom.nwfilm.org. I'm still archiving our episodes there. But now that we are on the playlist, that's where you're going to find this podcast sooner, you know, right away. Mm-hmm. And that's mostly our home now moving forward. So though you might be subscribed to the Adjust Your Tracking iTunes feed, you'll still get those eventually. But you're going to get this episode and all future ones right away if you go to the Playlist Podcast iTunes feed. So make sure to do that. Make sure to check out the playlist, which is a blog on the IndieWire blog network. That's how you can email us at adjustyourtracking@gmail.com. Where else can we be found, Joe?
Twitter at adjustyourtrack.
That's right. That's right.
Episodes are coming out. And we'll link you to articles that we think are worth your time.
Absolutely. And also on Facebook as well. You can find us there. And with that, we want to thank super producer Drew Wallner. He recently got to see BVS DOJ. And, you know, I don't want to put his wife on blast. She's a smart individual. She's a freaking doctor. She's smarter than any of us that just do this movie podcast. But she liked it. So, well, Drew, I know you're going to hear this. We might have to talk to Claire. She would be our first interviewee that me and Joe would have a lot of questions for. So, we'll hopefully deal with that and address it in another episode. But really, Drew, we thank you for all your hard work behind the scenes as super producer. Also got to thank social media intern Chelsea Fung. But first, foremost, and last on the podcast, I got to thank you, Joe, for talking with me today.
Thanks, Eric.